Dana, what are you talking about? She turned her cold green eyes on mine, and she looked older than before. She looked the way you did the morning after you'd pulled me from the water. Changed. Weary. I didn't threaten to tell anyone. I would never have done that to her. I loved her. None of you seem to get what that means. It's like you don't know what love is at all. I would have done anything for her. So, if you didn't threaten her? I think I knew the answer before she said it. It was Mum, she said. Jules. The room felt colder. If I believed in spirits, I would have said that you'd joined us. We did argue. Like I said, I didn't want her to see him any more. She said she didn't care what I thought, that it didn't matter. She said that I was immature, that I didn't understand what it was like to be in a real relationship. I called her a slut. She called me a virgin. It was that sort of fight. Stupid. Horrible. When Katie left, I realized that Mum was in her room, right next door. I thought she was out. She'd overheard the whole thing. She told me she had to speak to Louise about it. I begged her not to. I told her it would ruin Katie's whole life. So then she said maybe the best thing was to talk to Helen Townsend, because after all Mark was the one doing something wrong, and Helen is his boss. She said maybe they could get him fired but keep Katie's name out of it. I told her that was stupid, and she knew it was. They wouldn't just be able to fire him. It would have to be done officially. The police would get involved. It would go to court. It would be made public. And even if Katie's name wasn't in the papers, her parents would find out. Everyone at school would know. That stuff doesn't stay private. She took a deep breath, exhaling slowly. I told Mum at the time. I said Katie would rather die than go through that. Lena leaned forward and opened the kitchen window, then fished around in the pocket of her hoodie and pulled out a pack of cigarettes. She lit one and blew her smoke out into the air. I begged her. I mean it. I actually begged. And Mum told me that she'd have to think about it. She said that I had to convince Katie to stop seeing him, that it was an abuse of power and that it was totally wrong. She promised me that she wouldn't do anything without giving me time to persuade Katie. She crushed her barely smoked cigarette on the windowsill and flicked it towards the water. I believed her. I trusted her. She turned to face me again. But then a couple of days later, I saw Mum in the car park at school talking to Mr. Henderson. I don't know what they were talking about, but it didn't look friendly. And I knew I had to say something to Katie just in case, because she needed to know. She needed to be prepared. Her voice cracked, and she swallowed. She died 3 days later. Lena sniffed, wiping her nose with the back of her hand. The thing is, when we talked about it afterwards, Mum swore she never even mentioned Katie to Mark Henderson. She said they were arguing about me, about problems I was having in class. So, Lena, hang on, I don't understand. You're saying your mum didn't threaten them with exposure? I couldn't understand it either. She swore she hadn't said anything, but she felt so guilty. I could see it. I knew that it was my fault, but she kept acting like it was hers. She stopped swimming in the river, and she became obsessed with telling the truth. She kept going on and on about it, how it was wrong to be afraid of facing the truth, of letting people know the truth. She just went on and on. I wasn't sure if that was odd or perfectly consistent. You didn't tell the truth. You never did. The stories you'd been telling weren't the truth. They were your truth, your agenda. I should know. I've been on the dirty side of your truth most of my life. She didn't, did she? She never told anyone or wrote about Mark Henderson in her story about Katie. There's no mention of him. Lena shook her head, No, because I wouldn't let her. We fought and fought, and I kept telling her that I would have loved to see that piece of shit go to prison, but it would have broken Katie's heart, and it would have meant that she did what she did for nothing. She gulped. I mean, I know what Katie did was stupid, fucking pointless, but she died to protect him. And if we went to the police, that would mean her death meant nothing. But Mum just kept going on about the truth, how it was irresponsible to just let things go. She was... I don't know. She looked up at me, her gaze as cool as the one with which she'd fixed Louise, and said, You would know all this, Julia, if you'd only spoken to her. Lena, I'm sorry. I am sorry about that, but I still don't see why... Do you know how I know my mother killed herself? Do you know how I know for sure? I shook my head. Because on the day she died, we had a fight. It started over nothing, but it ended up being about Katie, like everything did. I was yelling at her and calling her a bad mother, and saying that if she'd been a good parent, she could have helped us, helped Katie, and then none of this would have happened. And she told me she had tried to help Katie, that she'd seen her walking home late one day, and had stopped to offer her a ride. She said Katie was all upset and wouldn't say why, and Mum said, You don't have to go through this by yourself. She said, I can help you, and your mum and dad can help you too. When I asked her why she'd never told me about that before, she wouldn't say. I asked her when it happened, and she said, Midsummer, June the 21st. Katie went to the pool that night. Without meaning to, it was Mum who tipped her over the edge. And so, like that, Katie tipped Mum over the edge too. A wave of sadness hit me, a swell so forceful I thought it might knock me from my chair. Was that it, Nell? After all this, you did jump, and you did it because you felt guilty and you despaired. You despaired because you had no one to turn to, not your angry, grieving daughter, and certainly not me, because you knew that if you called I wouldn't answer. Did you despair, Nell? Did you jump? I could feel Lena watching me, and I knew that she could see my shame, could see that finally I got it. I understood that I, too, was to blame. But she didn't look triumphant or satisfied. She just looked tired. I didn't tell the police any of this, because I didn't want anyone to know. I didn't want anyone to blame her, more than they already do in any case. She didn't do it out of hate, and she suffered enough, didn't she? She suffered things she shouldn't have, because it wasn't her fault. It wasn't hers or mine. She gave me a small, sad smile. It wasn't yours. It wasn't Louise's or Josh's. It wasn't our fault. I tried to embrace her, but she pushed me away. Don't, she said. Please, I just... She tailed off. Her chin lifted. I need to be by myself. Just for a bit. I'm going to go for a walk. I let her leave.
Nikki. Nikki did as Jeannie told her to. She went to talk to Lena Abbott. The weather had cooled, a hint of autumn coming early. So she wrapped herself up in her black coat, stuffed the pages into the inside pocket and walked across to the mill house. But when she got there, she found that there were other people around, and she was in no mood for a crowd, especially not after what the Whittaker woman said, about how all she cared about was money and exploiting people's grief, which wasn't fair at all. That was never what she intended, if only people would listen. She stood outside the house a while, watching, but her legs ached and her head was full of noise, and so she turned around and walked all the way back home again. Some days she felt her age, and some days she felt her mother's. She had no stomach for the day, for the fight ahead. Back in her room, she dozed in her chair, then woke and thought that maybe she had seen Lena heading for the pool, but it might have been a dream or a premonition. Later, though much later, in the dark, she was certain that she saw the girl, moving like a ghost through the square, a ghost with purpose fairly whipping along. Nikki could feel the split of the air she passed, the energy buzzing off her. She could feel it all the way up there in her dark little room, and it lifted her, stripped the years back. That was a girl on a mission. That girl had fire in her belly. She was a dangerous girl, the sort you don't mess with. Seeing Lena like that reminded Nikki of herself way back when. It made her want to get up and dance, made her want to howl at the moon. Well, her dancing days might be over, but pain or no pain, she decided she would make it to the river that night. She wanted to feel them up close, all those troublesome women, those troublesome girls, dangerous and vital. She wanted to feel their spirit, to bathe in it. She took 4 aspirin and got hold of her cane, then made her way slowly and carefully down the stairs, out of the back door and into the alley behind the shops. She hobbled across the square towards the bridge. It seemed to take a very long time. Everything took so long these days. No one warned you about that when you were younger. No one told you how slow you would become, and how bored you would be by your slowness. She should have foreseen it, she supposed, and she laughed to herself in the dark. Nikki could remember a time when she was fleet of foot, a whippet. Back then, when she was young, she and her sister ran races by the river, way upstream. They tore along, skirts tucked into their knickers, feeling every rock, every crevice in the hard ground through the soles of their flimsy plimsolls. Unstoppable they were. Later, much later, older and a bit slower, they met in the same spot upriver, and they walked together, sometimes for miles, often in silence. It was on one of those walks that they spotted Lauren, sitting on the steps at Anne Ward's place, a cigarette in her hand and her head leaning back against the door. Jeannie called out to her, and when Lauren looked up, they saw that the side of her face had all the colours of the sunset. "He's a devil, her old man," Jeannie had said. They say you speak of the devil and then you feel the heat. As Nikki stood there, remembering her sister, her elbows propped on the cold stone of the bridge, chin resting on her hands, eyes cast down at the water, she felt him. She felt him before she saw him. She hadn't spoken his name, but maybe Jeannie's whispering had conjured him up, the small-town Satan. Nikki turned her head, and there he was, walking towards her from the east side of the bridge, cane in one hand, cigarette in the other. Nikki spat on the ground like she always did, and said her invocation. Usually she'd leave it at that, but this night, and who knows why, maybe she was feeling Lena's spirit or Libby's or Anne's or Jeannie's, she called out. "It won't be long now," she said. Patrick stopped. He looked up as though surprised to see her.
"What's that?" he snarled. "What did you say?"
"I said, it won't be long now."
Patrick took a step towards her, and she felt the spirit again, angrily hot, surging up from her stomach to her chest and into her mouth.
"They've been talking to me lately."
Patrick waved a hand at her in dismissal, said something she couldn't hear. He continued on his way, and still the spirit wouldn't be silenced. She called out,
"My sister! Your wife, Nell Abbott, too. All of them, they've all been talking to me. And she had your number, didn't she, Nell Abbott?"
"Shut up, you old fool," Patrick spat.
He made as if to come towards her, just a feint, and Nikki started. He laughed, turning away again.
"Next time you speak to her," he called over his shoulder, "do give your sister my best."
Jules. I waited in the kitchen for Lena to come home. I rang her phone. I left voicemail messages,
I fretted hopelessly, and in my head you scolded me for not going after her, like you'd gone after me. You and I, we tell our stories differently. I know that, because I've read your words. When I was 17, I saved my sister from drowning. You were heroic, without context. You didn't write about how I got there, about the football game, or the blood, or Robbie, or the pool. When I was 17, I saved my sister from drowning, you say. But what a selective memory you have, Nell. I can still feel your hand on the back of my neck. I can still remember fighting against you, the agony of airless lungs, the cold panic when, even in my stupid, hopeless, drunken stupor, I knew I was going to drown. You held me there, Nell. Not for long. You changed your mind. With your arm locked around my neck, you dragged me towards the bank. But I've always known that there was some part of you that wanted to leave me there. You told me never to talk about it. You made me promise for Mum's sake, and so I put it away. I suppose I always thought that one day, far into the future, when we were old and you were different, when you were sorry, we'd return to it. We'd talk about what happened, about what I did and what you did, about what you said, and how we ended up hating each other. But you never said that you were sorry. And you never explained to me how it was that you could have treated me, your little sister, the way you did. You never changed. You just went and died. And I feel like my heart has been ripped out of my chest. I want so desperately to see you again. I waited for Lena until, defeated by exhaustion, I finally went to bed. I'd had so much trouble sleeping since I returned to this place, and it was catching up with me. I collapsed, drifting in and out of dreams, until I heard the door go downstairs, Lena's footsteps on the stairs. I heard her going into her room and turning her music on, loud enough for me to hear a woman sing about a blue-eyed girl. I slowly drifted back to sleep. When I woke again, the music was still playing, the same song. Louder now. I wanted it to stop, was desperate for it to stop, but I found I couldn't raise myself from the bed. I wondered whether I was awake at all, because if I was awake, what was this weight on my chest, crushing me? I couldn't breathe, couldn't move, but I heard the woman's voice loud and clear, and she was singing about the water. Suddenly the weight lifted, and I rose from the bed, furious. I stumbled into the hall and shouted for Lena to turn the music down. I lunged for her door handle and yanked the door open. The room was empty. Lights on, windows open, cigarette butts in the ashtray, a glass next to the empty bed. The music seemed to be getting louder and louder. My head pounded and my jaw ached, and I kept shouting even though there was no one there. I found the iPod dock and ripped it out of the wall, and at last, all I could hear was the sound of my own breath and my own blood pulsing in my ears. I returned to my room and phoned Lena again. When there was no answer, I tried Sean Townsend, but the call went straight to voicemail. Downstairs, the front door was locked and all the lights were on. I went from room to room, turning them off one by one, stumbling as though drunk, as though drugged. I lay down on the window seat where I used to sit and read books with my mother, where 22 years ago your boyfriend raped me, and again I fell asleep. I dreamed that the water was rising. I was upstairs in my parents' bedroom. I was lying on the bed with Robbie at my side. Outside, rain thundered down, the river kept on rising, and somehow I knew that downstairs the house was flooding. Slowly at first, just a trickle of water seeping under the door, and then more quickly, the doors and windows bursting open, filthy water pouring into the house, lapping against the stairs. Somehow I could see the living room, submerged in murky green, the river reclaiming the house, the water reaching the neck of the drowning dog, only now he was no longer a painted animal, he was real. His eyes were white and wide with panic, and he was struggling for his life. I tried to get up, to go downstairs to save him, but Robbie wouldn't let me. He was pulling my hair. I awoke with a start, panicked out of my nightmare. I checked my phone. It was after 3 in the morning. I could hear something, someone moving around the house. Lena was home. Thank God. I heard her coming down the stairs, her flip-flops slapping against stone. She stopped, framed in the doorway, the light behind her illuminating her silhouette. She started to move towards me. She was saying something, but I couldn't hear her, and I saw that she wasn't wearing flip-flops at all. She was wearing the heels she wore to the funeral, and the same black dress, which was dripping wet. Her hair clung to her face, and her skin was grey, her lips blue. She was dead. I woke up, gasping. My heart was hammering in my chest. The banquette beneath me was soaked with sweat. I sat up, confused. I looked at the paintings opposite me, and they seemed to shift, and I thought, I'm still asleep. I can't wake. I can't wake. I pinched my skin as hard as I could, dug my nails into the flesh of my forearm and saw real marks, felt real pain. The house was dark and silent, save for the river's quiet susurration. I called Lena's name. I ran upstairs and along the corridor. Lena's door was ajar and the light was on. The room was exactly as I'd left it hours before, the water glass and the unmade bed and the ashtray untouched. Lena wasn't home. She hadn't been home. She was gone.
Part 3. Monday, the 24th of August. Mark. It was late when he got home, just after 2 o'clock in the morning. His flight from Malaga had been delayed, and then he'd lost his ticket for the car park, and it had taken him an infuriating 45 minutes to find his car. Now he wished it had taken longer. He wished he had never found the car at all, had had to stay in a hotel. He could have been spared then for just one more night. Because when he realized in the darkness that all the windows of his house had been smashed, he knew that he wouldn't be sleeping that night or any night. Rest was over, peace of mind destroyed. He had been betrayed. He wished, too, that he had been colder, harder, that he had strung his fiancée along. Then, when they came for him, he would be able to say, "Me? I'm just back from Spain. 4 days in Andalusia with my fiancée, my attractive, professional, 29-year-old girlfriend." It wouldn't have made a difference, though, would it? It wouldn't matter what he said, what he did, how he'd lived his life. They would crucify him anyway. It wouldn't matter to the newspapers, to the police, the school, the community, that he wasn't some deviant with a history of chasing after girls half his age. It wouldn't matter that he had fallen in love, and been fallen in love with. The mutuality of their feelings would be ignored. Katie's maturity, her seriousness, her intelligence, her choice. None of these things would matter. All they would see was his age, 29, and hers, 15, and they would rip his life apart. He stood on the lawn, staring at the boarded-up windows, and he sobbed. If there had been anything left to smash, he would have broken it himself then. He stood on the lawn and he cursed her, cursed the day he'd first set eyes on her, so much more beautiful than her silly, self-assured friends. He cursed the day she'd walked slowly towards his desk, full hips swinging gently and a smile on her lips, and asked, "Mr. Henderson, can I ask for your help with something?" The way she'd leaned towards him, close enough that he could smell her clean, unperfumed skin. He'd been startled at first, and angry. He'd thought she was toying with him, teasing him. Hadn't she been the one who started all this? And why should it be him, then, left alone to suffer the consequences? He stood on the lawn, tears in his eyes, panic rising in his throat, and he hated Katie, and he hated himself, and he hated the stupid mess he'd got himself into, from which he now saw no escape. What to do? Go into the house, pack the rest of his things and leave? Run? His mind fogged. Where to go and how? Were they already watching? They must be. If he withdrew money, would they know? If he tried to leave the country again, would they be there? He imagined the scene, the passport official glancing at his photo and picking up a phone, uniformed men dragging him from a queue of holidaymakers, the curious looks on their faces. Would they know, when they saw him, what he was? No drug dealer, no terrorist, no. He must be something else, something worse. He looked at the blank and boarded windows and imagined that they were inside. They were waiting for him there. They'd already been through his things, his books and his papers. They'd already turned the house upside down, searching for evidence of what he had done. And they would have found nothing. He felt the faintest gleam of hope. There was nothing to find. No love letters, no pictures on his laptop, no evidence at all that she had ever set foot in his house. The bed linen long gone, the entire house cleaned, disinfected, scrubbed of every last trace of her. What evidence would they have, save for the fantasies of a vindictive teenage girl? The teenage girl who had tried herself to win his favour and had been resoundingly knocked back. No one knew. No one really knew what had passed between himself and Katie, and no one need know. Nell Abbott was ash, and her daughter's word worth just about as much. He gritted his teeth and fished for his keys in his pocket, and then walked around the house and opened the back door. She came at him before he had time to turn on the light. Barely flesh, nothing but a dark maw, teeth and nails. He batted her away, but she came again. What choice did he have? What choice did she leave him? And now there was blood on the floor, and he didn't have time to clean it up. It was getting light. He had to go.
Jules. It came to me quite suddenly. An epiphany. One moment I was terrified and panicking, and the next I was not, because I knew. Not where Lena was, but who she was. And with that, I could start to look for her. I was sitting in the kitchen, dazed, punch drunk. The police had left, gone back to the river to continue the search. They told me to stay put, just in case she came home. "Keep calling," they said. "Keep your phone on. Okay, Julia? Keep your phone on." They talked to me as though I were a child. I couldn't blame them, I suppose, because they'd been sitting there asking me questions I couldn't answer. I knew when I had seen Lena last, but I couldn't say when she was last in the house. I didn't know what she'd been wearing when she left. I couldn't remember what she'd been wearing when I saw her last. I couldn't distinguish dream from reality. Was the music real, or did I imagine that? Who locked the door? Who turned on the lights? The detectives eyed me with suspicion and disappointment. Why did I let her go, if she was so distressed after her confrontation with Louise Whittaker? How could I not have run after her to comfort her? I saw the looks that passed between them, the unspoken judgment. What sort of guardian will this woman make? You were in my head too, admonishing me. Why didn't you go after her like I went after you? Why didn't you save her like I saved you? When I was 17, I saved my sister from drowning. When you were 17, Nell, you drove me into the water and held me down. That old argument, back and forth, you say, I say, you say, I say. I was losing the stomach for it. I didn't want to have it any longer. And that was where it was. In the buzz of exhaustion, the sick thrill of fear, I saw something, caught sight of something. It was as though something moved, a shadow just out of my line of sight. "Was it really me?" you asked, "who drove you to the water?" Was it you, or was it Robbie, or some combination of the two? The floor seemed to tilt, and I grabbed hold of the kitchen counter to steady myself. Some combination of the two. I felt breathless, my chest tight, as though I were going to have a panic attack. I waited for the world to go white, but it didn't. I kept standing. I kept breathing. Some combination. I ran to the stairs, bolted up them and into your room, and there, that picture of you with Lena, when she's smiling her predator's smile, that isn't you. That isn't your smile. It's his. It's Robbie Cannon's. I can see it now, flashing up at me while he lies on top of your body and pushes your shoulders down into the sand. That's who she is, who Lena is. She's a combination of the two of you. Lena is yours, and she is his. Lena is Robbie Cannon's daughter.
Jules.
I sat down on the bed, the photo frame in my hand. You and she smiled up at me, bringing bright hot tears to my eyes, and finally I cried for you, as I should have done at your funeral. I thought of him that day, the way he'd looked at Lena. I'd misread that look completely. It wasn't predatory, it was proprietary. He wasn't looking at her as a girl to be seduced, to be possessed. She already belonged to him. So maybe he'd come for her, to take what was rightfully his. He wasn't hard to find. His father used to have a string of flashy car dealerships all over the Northeast. Cannon Cars, the company was called. That didn't exist any longer. It had gone bankrupt years ago. But there was a smaller, sadder, low-rent version in Gateshead. I found a badly designed website with a picture of him on its homepage, the photo taken some time ago by the look of it. Less paunchy then, still a hint of the handsome, cruel boy in his face. I didn't call the police, because I was sure they wouldn't listen to me. I just picked up the car keys and left. I was feeling almost pleased with myself as I drove out of Beckford. I'd figured it out. I was taking control. And the further I drove from the village, the stronger I felt, the fog of tiredness clearing, my limbs loosening. I felt hungry, savagely hungry, and I relished the sensation. I chewed the side of my cheek and tasted iron. Some old part of me, some furious, fearless relic had surfaced. I imagined myself lashing out at him, clawing at him. I pictured myself an Amazon, ripping him limb from limb. The garage was in a run-down part of town, under the railway arches. An ominous place. By the time I arrived, I was no longer brave. My hands shook as I reached to change gear or flick the indicator switch. The taste in my mouth was bile, not blood. I was trying to focus on what I had to do. To find Lena, to make Lena safe. But all my energy was sapped by the effort it took to push back against memories I hadn't let surface for over half a lifetime, memories which rose now like driftwood out of water. I parked across the road from the garage. There was a man standing outside, smoking a cigarette, a younger man, not Cannon. I got out of the car and on trembling legs crossed the road to talk to him. "I was hoping to speak to Robert Cannon," I said. "That your motor, is it?" he said, indicating the car behind me. "You can just bring it in." "No, it's not about that. I need to speak to..." "Is he here?" "It's not about the motor. He's in the office," he said, jerking his head to indicate behind him. "You can go on in if you want." I peered into the cavernous dark space, and my stomach contracted. "No," I said, as firmly as I could. "I'd prefer to speak to him out here." He sucked his teeth and flicked his half-smoked cigarette into the street. "Suit yourself," he said, and strolled on inside. I slipped my hand into my pocket and realized that my phone was in my handbag, which was still on the passenger seat. I turned to go back, knowing that if I did, I wouldn't return, that if I made it to the safety of the driver's seat, I would lose all courage completely. I would start the engine and drive away. "Can I help you?" I froze. "Did you want something, pet?" I turned around, and there he was, uglier even than he had looked on the day of the funeral. His face had become heavy and hangdog, his nose purpled, mapped with blue veins, which spread to his cheeks like an estuary. His gait was familiar, listing side to side like a ship as he approached. He peered at me. "Do I know you?" "You're Robert Cannon?" I asked.
"Yes," he said. "I'm Robbie."
For a fraction of a second, I felt sorry for him. It was the way he said his name, still using the diminutive. Robbie is a child's name, the name of a little boy who runs around the back garden and climbs trees. It's not the name of some overweight loser, some bankrupt running a dodgy garage in a shitty part of town. He stepped towards me, and I caught a whiff of him, body odour and booze, and any pity evaporated as my body remembered the feeling of his, crushing the breath out of me.
"Look, love, I'm very busy," he said.
My hands clenched into fists.
"Is she here?" I asked.
"Is who here?"
He frowned, then rolled his eyes, reaching into his jeans pocket for his cigarettes.
"Ah, fuck's sake, you're not a mate of Shelley's, are you? Because as I told her, old man, I haven't seen the slag in weeks, so if it's about that, you can just do one, all right?"
"Lena Abbott," I said, my voice little more than a hiss. "Is she here?" He lit his cigarette. Behind his dull brown eyes, something sparked.
"You're looking for... who now? Nell Abbott's girl? Who are you?"
He looked around him.
"Why do you think Nell's girl would be here?"
He wasn't faking it. He was too stupid to fake it. I could see that. He didn't know where Lena was. He didn't know who she was. I turned to go. The longer I stayed, the more he'd wonder, the more I'd give away.
"Hang on,"
he said, placing a hand on my shoulder, and I spun round, shoving him away from me.
"Easy,"
he said, raising his hands, looking around as though for backup.
"What's going on here? Are you..."
He squinted at me.
"I saw you. You were at the funeral."
Finally, it dawned on him.
"Julia!"
His face broke into a smile.
"Julia! Bloody hell! I didn't recognize you before."
He took me in, head to toe.
"Julia! Why didn't you say something?"
He offered me a cup of tea. I started laughing, and I couldn't stop. I laughed until tears streamed down my face, while he stood there, half giggling along at first, until his uncertain mirth petered out, and he stood, dull and uncomprehending, watching me.
"What's going on?"
he asked, irritated. I wiped my eyes with the back of my hand.
"Lena ran off," I said. "I've been looking for her everywhere. I thought maybe..."
"Well, she isn't here. Why on earth do you think she'd be here? I didn't even know the kid. First time I laid eyes on her was at the funeral. Gave me a bit of a turn, if I'm honest. She's so like Nell."
He rearranged his features into a facsimile of concern.
"I was sorry to hear about what happened. Really sorry, Julia."
He tried to touch me again, but I pulled away. He took a step closer to me.
I can't believe you're Julia. You look so different."
An ugly smile smeared across his face.
"Don't know how I can forget," he said quietly, his voice low. "I popped your cherry, didn't I, girl?"
he laughed.
"Long time ago now."
Popped your cherry. Pop. A joyful sound of balloons and birthday parties, and cherries, sweet on the lips, delicious and sticky. These things were a million miles from his slimy tongue in my mouth and his dirty fingers pushing me open. I thought I would gag. "No, Robbie," I said, and I was surprised by how clear my voice sounded, how loud, how steady.
"You didn't pop my cherry. You raped me."
The smile slipped from his ruined face. He cast a glance over his shoulder before stepping towards me again. My head swimming with adrenaline now, breath quickening, I clenched my fists and stood my ground.
"I what?" he hissed. "I fucking what? I never... I didn't... rape you?"
He whispered it, rape, as though afraid someone might hear us.
I was 13 years old, I said. I told you to stop. I was crying my fucking eyes out. I had to stop, because I could feel the tears filling my throat, drowning my voice, and I didn't want to cry in front of the bastard now. You cried 'cause it was your first time, he said, his voice low, wheedling. Because it hurt a bit. You never said you didn't want to. You never said no. Then louder, definitive. You lying bitch! You never said no! Now he started laughing. I could have whatever I wanted. Don't you remember? I had half the girls in Beckford trailing after me with their knickers wet. I had your sister, who was the hottest girl around. You honestly think I needed to rape a fat cow like you? He believed it. I could see that he believed every word he said. And in that moment, I was defeated. All this time, he'd never felt guilty. He'd never felt a second of remorse, because in his head, what he'd done wasn't rape. All this time, and he still believed he'd been doing the fat girl a favour. I walked away from him. Behind me, I could hear him coming after me, swearing under his breath. You always were a mad bitch, weren't you? You always were. Can't believe you coming and saying this kind of shit, saying... I stopped suddenly, a few feet from the car. Wasn't there some part of you that liked it? Something shifted. If Robbie didn't think he'd raped me, how could you have done? What were you talking about, Nell? What were you asking me? Some part of me that liked what? I turned around. Robbie was standing behind me, hands hanging at his sides like slabs of meat, his mouth open. Did she know? I asked him. What? Did Nell know? I yelled at him. His lip curled. Did Nell know what? That I fucked you? You're joking, aren't you? Imagine what she'd have said to that if I'd told her I'd banged her little sister just after I was done banging her. He laughed. I told her the first bit, how you tried it on, how you were drunk and sloppy and leaning all over me and looking up at me with your sad fat face and begging, please, like a little dog you were, always hanging around, always watching us whenever I was with her, spying on us, even when we were in bed you liked to watch, didn't you? Thought we didn't notice, didn't you? He laughed again. We did. We used to joke about what a little perv you were. Sad little fatso, never been touched, never been kissed. Like to watch your hot sister getting it. He shook his head. Rape. Don't make me laugh. You wanted some of what Nell was getting. You made that very fucking clear. I pictured myself sitting under the trees, standing outside the bedroom, watching. He was right. I did watch them, but not with lust, not with envy, with a kind of horrible fascination. I watched the way a child does, because that was what I was. I was a little girl who didn't want to see what was being done to her sister, because that's what it looked like. It always looked as though something was being done to you, but who couldn't look away? I told her you tried it on with me, and then you ran off crying when I knocked you back, and she ran off after you. There was a sudden tumbling of images in my head. The sound of your words, the heat of your anger, the pressure of your hands as you held me down in the water, and then grabbed my hair and pulled me to the bank. You bitch! You stupid fat bitch! What have you done? What are you trying to do? Or was it... You stupid bitch, what were you doing? And then it was, I know he hurt you, but what did you expect? I made it to the car, fumbling for my keys with trembling hands. Robbie was still behind me, still talking. Yeah, run along then, you lying slag. You never thought that girl was here, did you? That was an excuse, wasn't it? You came to see me. Did you want another taste? I could hear him laughing as he walked away, delivering his parting shot from across the street. Ha! No chance, pet. Not this time. You might have lost a bit of weight, but you're still a fucking minger. I started the car, pulled away, stalled. Cursing, I started the engine again and lurched off down the road, putting my foot down, putting as much distance as possible between him and me and what had just happened, and knowing I should be worrying about Lena, but unable to think about that because all I could think was this. You didn't know. You didn't know that he raped me. When you said, "I'm sorry he hurt you," you meant you were sorry I felt rejected. When you said, "What did you expect?" you meant that of course he would reject me. I was just a child. And when you asked me, "Wasn't there some part of you that liked it?" you weren't talking about sex. You were talking about the water. The scales fell. I have been blind and blinkered. You didn't know. I pulled the car over to the side of the road and started to sob, my whole body racked with the awful, horrible knowledge. You didn't know. All these years, Nell, all these years, I attributed to you the most vicious cruelty. And what had you done to deserve it? What did you do to deserve it? All those years, and I didn't listen. I never listened to you. And now it seemed impossible that I could not have seen, could not have understood that when you asked me, "Wasn't there some part of you that liked it?" you were talking about the river, about that night at the river. You wanted to know what it felt like to abandon yourself to the water. I stopped crying. In my head, you muttered, "You don't have time for this, Julia." And I smiled. "I know," I said out loud. "I know." I didn't care any longer what Robbie thought. I didn't care that he'd spent all his life telling himself he did nothing wrong. That's what men like him do. And what does it matter what he thought? He was nothing to me. What mattered was you. What you knew and didn't know, and that I'd been punishing you all your life for something you didn't do. And now I had no way to tell you I was sorry. Back in Beckford, I stopped the car on the bridge, climbed down the mossy steps, and walked along the river path. It was early afternoon. The air was cooling, and the breeze was getting up. Not a perfect day for a swim, but I'd been waiting so long, and I wanted to be there with you. It was the only way now that I could get close to you, the only thing I had left. I took off my shoes and stood in jeans and t-shirt on the bank. I started to walk forward, one foot after the other. I closed my eyes, gasping, as my feet sank into the cool mud. But I didn't stop. I kept going. And when the water closed over my head, I realized through my terror that it did feel good. It did.
Mark. Blood seeped through the bandage wrapped around Mark's hand. He'd not done a very good job of patching it up, and try as he might, he couldn't stop himself from gripping the steering wheel too tightly. His jaw ached and a bright, startling pain pulsed behind his eyes. The vice was back again, clamped around his temples. He could feel the blood squeezing through the veins in his head, could almost hear his skull begin to crack. Twice he'd had to stop the car at the side of the road to throw up. He had no idea where to run. He'd started off by driving north, back towards Edinburgh, but halfway there he'd changed his mind. Would they expect him to go that way? Would there be roadblocks at the entrance to the city? Torchlights shone in his face, rough hands dragging him from the car, quiet voices telling him there's worse to come than this. Far worse. He turned back and took a different route. He couldn't think with his head splitting like this. He needed to stop, to breathe, to plan. He turned off the main road and drove towards the coast. Everything he'd feared was coming to pass. He saw his future unravelling before him, and he played it over and over in his mind. The police at the door, the journalist screaming questions at him as he was dragged, head covered with a blanket, to a car. Windows repaired, just to be smashed again. Vile insults on the walls, excrement through the letterbox. The trial. Oh, God, the trial. The look on his parents' faces as Lena levelled her accusations, the questions the court would ask, when and where and how many times. The shame. The conviction. Prison. Everything he'd warned Katie about. Everything he'd told her he would face. He wouldn't survive it. He told her that he wouldn't survive it. That Friday evening in June, he hadn't been expecting her. She was supposed to be going to a birthday party, something she couldn't get out of. He remembered opening the door, feeling the rush of pleasure he always got from looking at her, before he had time to process the look on her face. Anxious. Suspicious. He'd been seen that afternoon, speaking to Nell Abbott in the school car park. What had they been talking about? Why was he speaking to Nell at all? I was seen. By whom? He was amused. He thought she was jealous. Katie turned away, rubbing her hand against the back of her neck, the way she did whenever she felt nervous or self-conscious. Kay, what's the matter? She knows, Katie said quietly, without looking at him, and the ground fell away, pitching him into nothingness. He grabbed hold of her arm, twisting her round to face him. I think Nell Abbott knows. And then it all came tumbling out, all the things she'd lied about, the things she'd been hiding from him. Lena had known for months. Katie's brother, too.
Jesus Christ! Jesus Christ! Katie, how could you not tell me? How could you... Jesus!
He'd never yelled at her before. He could see how frightened she was, how terrified and upset, and yet he couldn't stop himself.
Do you understand what they'll do to me? Do you fucking understand what it's like to go to prison as a sex offender?
You're not, she cried. He grabbed her again. He felt hot even now with the shame of it.
But I am. That's exactly what I am. That is what you've made me.
He told her to leave, but she refused. She begged, pleaded. She swore to him that Lena would never talk. Lena would never say anything to anyone about it.
Lena loves me. She would never hurt me.
She'd persuaded Josh that it was over, that nothing had ever actually happened, that he had nothing to worry about, that if he did say something, all it would do was break their parents' hearts. But Nell...
I'm not even sure if she does know, Katie told him. Lena said she might have overheard something.
She tailed off, and he could tell by the cut of her gaze that she was lying. He couldn't believe her, couldn't believe anything she said. This beautiful girl who had entranced him, bewitched him, couldn't be trusted. It was over, he told her, watching her face crumple. Disentangling himself as she tried to wrap her arms around him, pushing her away, gently at first, and then more firmly.
No, listen, listen to me. I cannot see you any longer. Not like this. Not ever. Do you understand? It is over. It never happened. There is nothing between us. There was never anything between us.
Please, don't say that, Mark, please.
She was sobbing so hard she could barely breathe, and his heart broke.
Please, don't say that. I love you.
He felt himself weaken. He let her hold him. He let her kiss him. He felt his resolve subside. She pressed herself into him, and he had a sudden, clear image of another pressing against him, and not just one but several, male bodies pressing against his beaten, broken, violated body. He saw this and pushed her violently away.
No, no, do you have any idea what you've done? You have ruined my life, do you understand that? When this gets out, when that bitch tells the police, and she will tell the police, my life will be over. Do you know what they do to men like me in prison? You know, don't you? Do you think I'll survive that? I won't. My life will be over.
He saw the fear and hurt in her face, and still he said,
And it will be down to you.
When they pulled her body from the pool, Mark punished himself. For days, he could barely get out of bed, and yet he had to face the world. He had to go to school, to look at her empty chair, to face the grief of her friends and her parents and show none of his own. He, the one who loved her most, was not permitted to grieve for her the way she deserved.
He wasn't permitted to grieve the way he deserved to, because although he punished himself for what he had said to her in anger, he knew that this wasn't really his fault. None of it was his fault. How could it be? Who could control the one they fell in love with?
Mark heard a thump and jumped, swerving out into the middle of the road, overcorrecting back again and skidding onto the graveled verge. He checked the rear-view mirror. He thought he'd hit something, but there was nothing there. Nothing but empty tarmac. He took a deep breath and squeezed the wheel again, wincing as it pressed into the wound on his hand. He switched on the radio, turned it up as loud as it would go. He still had no idea what he was going to do with Lena. His first idea had been to drive north to Edinburgh, dump the car in a car park, and then get the ferry to the continent. They'd find her soon enough. Well, they'd find her eventually. He might feel terrible, but he had to keep reminding himself that this was not his fault. She came at him, not the other way round. And when he tried to fight her off, fend her off, she just came at him again and again, shouting and clawing, talons drawn. He had fallen, sprawling on the kitchen floor, his carry-on bag skidding away from him across the tiles. And from it fell, as though directed by a deity with a sick sense of humour, the bracelet. The bracelet he'd been carrying around since he took it from Helen Townsend's desk. This thing which held a power he hadn't yet figured out how to wield. Out it came, skittering across the floor between them. Lena looked at it as though it were an alien thing. It might as well have been glowing green kryptonite from the expression on her face. And then confusion passed, and she was upon him again, only this time she had the kitchen scissors in her hand, and she was swinging hard at him, at his face, at his neck, swinging like she meant it. He raised his hands in self-defense, and she sliced one of them open. It throbbed now, angrily, in time with his racing heartbeat. Thump, thump, thump. He checked the rear view again. No one behind him. And jammed his foot on the brake. There was a sickening, satisfying thud as her body slammed into metal, and all was quiet again. He pulled the car over to the side of the road again, not to be sick this time, but to weep. For himself, for his ruined life. He cried racking sobs of frustration and despair. He beat his right hand against the steering wheel again and again and again, until it hurt as much as the left one. Katie was 15 years and 2 months old the first time they slept together. Another 10 months and she would have been legal. They would have been untouchable, legally in any case. He'd have had to walk away from the job, and some people might still have thrown stones. They'd still have called him names, but he could have lived with that. They could have lived with it. 10 fucking months. They should have waited. He should have insisted they wait. Katie was the one in a hurry. Katie was the one who couldn't stay away. Katie was the one who forced the issue, who wanted to make him hers undeniably. And now she was gone, and he was the one who was going to pay for it. The unfairness of it rankled. It seared his flesh like acid. And the vice just kept squeezing tighter and tighter, and he wished to God it would just crush him, split his head open, and like her, like Katie, he'd be done with it.
Lena. I was frightened when I woke up. I didn't know where I was. I couldn't see a thing. It was totally dark. But I realized from the noise, the movement and the smell of petrol that I was in a car. My head was really sore and my mouth too. It was hot and stuffy and there was something digging into my back. Something hard, like a metal bolt.